You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Darrell Connor.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at why some people are sounding the alarm about declining recruitment for new police officers here in Wisconsin and around the nation.
First, for some people who commit a crime in Wisconsin, a few are able to participate in a practice that allows the offender, the victim, and the community to come together to talk about the offense and learn from mistakes.
Restorative justice is a voluntary system used in specific instances in different communities. Many people who have participated have said that restorative justice does more to rehabilitate offenders than just something like jail time. They also say it allows victims to get closure from the incident and makes the community accountable to both parties.
Coming up in just a bit, we'll learn more about how this method fits into the overall conversation about crime and criminal justice. But first, we talk to a state lawmaker who's making the case for restorative justice practices to be used more widely in Wisconsin.
Democratic State Senator Lena Taylor joins us. She represents Wisconsin's 4th Senate District, which includes Milwaukee. Senator Taylor, welcome back to Central Time.
Always a pleasure.
Now, how did restorative justice first grab your attention and get on your radar?
Well, you know, I'm a lawyer by profession, and this is something that I've been involved in actually since David Lerman was the assistant district attorney who proposed to then DA Mike McCann. I couldn't think of his name. And when he proposed it back then, originally this concept started with just retail theft. And then we quickly learned that all of the stats show that the concept of restorative justice is a pathway to transformational reform and repairing damage that's been caused by the crime, and for individuals who are the defendants to see the effects that they literally have caused in their community, the depth of the hurt, the pain, and the harm, not only to the victim, but the victim's family and even individuals that are connected to the defendant. It was just, you know, I've experienced working through these circles, these processes, and it is really amazing how eye-opening it can be for not only the defendant, but how healing it can be for them and for the victim.
And
so I got involved back when I was a public defender.
And you write that this is kind of a different way of thinking about crime and punishment. This is looking at not just kind of the state versus a defendant, but the community, the people affected by the crime, not just the victim, but how it affects people in a neighborhood. What is it like to think in that different way?
You know, this concept has been going on for more than 40 years around the world. But as I mentioned, it's something that started in the Milwaukee County area back when I was a public defender, and I can't even believe it was way back in like 1996 or 3. And so it's like, oh my goodness. But the effect can create major truth, dialogue, healing, and solutions. It's an opportunity for the defendant to be human and to see the humanity of the victims and to see the scars that they create. That's a kind of healing to trauma that doesn't really exist, right, outside of these restorative justice kinds of efforts. And I'm really excited. I don't know if you've had an opportunity to meet the newly elected Representative Kalen Haywood-elect. He is the youngest African-American legislator in the nation at 19, and one of the things that he did was start a restorative justice program even in the schools. So it is healing for our young people so that we can build a new generation that thinks like this, but it's healing for our community because of all of those pieces that we've talked about.
Are we using restorative justice enough right now, or do you see a lot more room for growth?
Oh, definitely a lot more room for growth. We are not using it enough. Dane County has a restorative justice court. We don't have that in the largest city in the state, the first-class city, Milwaukee. And so, of course, there is more that we need to do. It gives accountability, right, to offenders that they don't normally have at a depth that I think awakens their humanity within them. And so we need to do more of that because it's like a giving back to what you helped to destroy. And I think those practices should be not only with adults, I think they should be with youth. I think it should be properly implemented because I think it will help us to manage conflict. I mean, think about it. Restorative justice is really a way for people not only to be heard, but for those conversations to happen in a safe place.
You mentioned properly implemented, and I've heard people say restorative justice is great when it's done right, but sometimes a school or a community says, okay, now we're doing restorative justice, but they haven't done the training. They don't have the expertise. They don't have the right methods in place. What would you do to make sure that as restorative justice is expanded, it gets the resources it would need to support it?
You know, I'm hoping that the Attorney General sees this as something to invest in, as well as the legislature and the new incoming also governor. And so that's, you know, one way is that it's done in the budget, that it's done through the Attorney General, who is, so to say, the top cop of the state. But it has to be based on the values of that community, right? And it has to have principles that are consistent with inclusion. It has to be facilitated dialogue so that no one feels re-victimized, for lack of a better way to say it, sitting in that meeting. And we have to deal with the truth. I mean, like, we foundationally have to say, like, the hurt, the harm, and we have to be honest about that has been done. And we have to talk about how to restore that. We have to talk about what is it that will help a person, right, get from wherever they are in whatever hurt or that they've caused or whatever hurt they've experienced if they're the victim. And we have to also make sure humanity is incorporated in that, because if we don't, then basically what we're saying is, you know, this is just a, you know, I don't want to call it an itching session, but, you know, that it'll just be that. So it's really important that we do that. And these people who normally have participated in it are volunteers. And as you said, we have to make sure they are adequately trained by individuals who are credentialed in knowing what to do. I think if we do that, we could prevent a lot of what happens in municipal court for teenagers. I think that we would be able to put them on a different path. It's a way that we could deal with a lot of unpaid citations, especially in communities like Milwaukee, where, you know, we're becoming quickly like Ferguson, a debtor's prison, you know, kind of concept. And so, and we have to track what it does, because I believe that it will have an effect to increase safety. It will have an effect to lessen the cost of our traditional justice system. It will create stronger communities, and it will reduce recidivism. So I think it's important that whatever gets implemented needs to adequately track what's going on, or, you know, what is it?
We'll leave it there. Senator Taylor, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Senator Lena Taylor represents Wisconsin's 4th Senate District in the state legislature. Her district includes Milwaukee. She joined us to talk about restorative justice efforts in Wisconsin.
Our next guest is a restorative justice expert and helped establish the Dane County Restorative Justice Court in 2014. He's with us to talk about how to put the method into practice.
Jonathan Schar is director of the Restorative Justice Project at the University of Wisconsin Law School's Frank J. Remington Center. Jonathan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we heard the case for restorative justice from Senator Taylor there. Take us into how this works. I think we can all imagine a criminal trial based on seeing one or seeing one on TV. What happens at a restorative justice session, meeting?
Sure. So there's a number of different models or methods that could be employed to how it operates. But a general session, so some of the things that Senator Taylor talked about is really making sure that we have the correct individuals there, right? So you're going to have, generally, you might have the victim, the individual responsible for harm in a particular criminal matter, and then also representatives of the community. And the important element, as she noted, was individuals with proper training. And that also includes community members who've been trained in restorative justice and restorative practices. And so what happens is, after a process, you know, might get a referral, spends a significant amount of time usually meeting with each individual. So this is the pre-work that needs to be done. So a pre-conference or pre-circle work that is done, meeting with each individual to understand who this person is, to find out what has happened, to explore what the impact of what this harm or crime has caused to people's lives. And that's everybody, right? So she mentioned in there this idea, or at least alluded to the idea of the ripple effect. And that is that crime doesn't just affect sort of the direct victim, but there are many other individuals who are impacted when a harm or crime occurs. And that's going to be right around that direct victim, so their family, their friends. And the same sorts of ripples exist around the individual responsible for that harm. So the first thing is bringing people... So speaking with those individuals and really understanding what happened and understanding again how people have been affected, and then really trying to determine where do we go from here. So the thing about restorative justice is really that it is future oriented. So we'll figure out what is needed to repair the harm. So when we meet with both individuals separately, then ultimately what we will do is then bring individuals together. So you'll bring the individual responsible for harm. You might bring the victim together along with community members, and then have a facilitated process where you walk through those very specific things of what happened, how people have been affected, and then what people think needs to be done in order to repair the harm. And that's really where we see the accountability. So bringing together and activating those three key elements, right? Again, so victim, the person responsible for harm, and community, allows us to engage in a very different way around a harm and around a crime that has occurred.
So a courtroom in a criminal trial might assign jail time or a fine or community supervision. What kind of outcomes come out for the person who perpetrated the crime from a restorative justice process?
Sure. So the first thing is about establishing understanding. And that, again, is about understanding the impact of what has happened. So that's part of the discussion. Then when we look at what does something like a repair harm agreement look like, that can be incredibly varied. So that is as unique as the individuals and as unique as the case itself. And really, you can have those things look almost however you want. So there might be, again, direct apology that may occur with people, or even something like direct service, right? So if someone has directly harmed another individual, and in some way they can directly pay back that person via personal service or service to something that is important to them. Maybe it is to a cause or a population group that's important to them. This idea of targeted and meaningful community service that occurs. And then there's sort of other creative solutions that, like I said, could be whatever the victim feels that they need. So that's sort of unique to the individual. So again, for some people that, like, is an apology or is a reflection, is specific acts of service, is specific things that someone wants a person to do. So it gives a victim a voice of saying, like, here's what I want to see happen. Here's what I would like to see done. Here's what I think the appropriate response is for the person who's responsible for causing that harm. Here's what I think this person should do in order to sort of pay me back, to repair some of the harm that has occurred. That obviously can include restitution for any sort of monetary damage that has occurred or any sort of loss that has occurred. But again, can go well beyond that into very, very creative solutions for people.
We're talking to Jonathan Schar right now, director of the Restorative Justice Project at the UW Law School's Frank J. Remington Center. He's with us to talk about how restorative justice is used in some parts of Wisconsin and the impact it can have on communities.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. What do you think of restorative justice efforts? What questions do you have about the process? And if you've participated in restorative justice, we'd love to hear your story. You can call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@WPR.org.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
We continue our conversation about restorative justice efforts in the state with Jonathan Schar. He's the director of the Restorative Justice Project at the University of Wisconsin's Law School Frank J. Remington Center, and helped start the Dane County Restorative Justice Court.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about restorative justice? Have you experienced it yourself as a participant on one side of the table or the other? We'd love to hear from you. And what do you think of this idea of using restorative justice in Wisconsin's criminal justice system? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to a caller right away. We've got Luke on the line in Milwaukee. Luke, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up, Luke?
Well, I was actually kind of wondering, first off, I'd like to say that I know any kind of restorative program has to be better than what we currently have with the U.S. prison system. But what I was wondering with this specific Restorative Justice Act, does this really work in the case of really heinous crimes like murder, things that may never be able to be taken back? How is this kind of handled?
Luke, thanks for the call. Is this, are cases of murder or other irreparable harm something that would come up in restorative justice, Jonathan?
Sure. So, Luke, thanks for the call. Actually, so this area of serious and sensitive crime is actually where I spend the vast majority of my time. Our project actually facilitates the vast majority of victim-offender dialogues and serious and sensitive crimes around the state, which includes very serious crimes, again, homicides, sexual-based offenses, armed robberies, burglaries, things like that. And where we see that primarily is in this context of sort of post-adjudication. So that's really restorative justice after the court system has taken place. So a lot of what the context we're talking about here is as an alternative to the criminal justice system. But again, this question brings up a really important point that it's really possible at all points and phases in the criminal justice system. So there's this point, again, where we're working often in these serious cases, which is after the court process has happened. But I can even say that I spent a couple months ago working alongside the criminal justice process on a case that resulted in someone's death, and working with the families involved, the person responsible for that, and again, really bringing connection and healing into this space that is artificially separated by our traditional justice system. And the results in that case, again, were very positive, where people were able to, again, ask questions, find out and understand more about what happened and how people have been impacted, that allowed them to move forward rather than waiting sort of years and years or waiting for a justice process or a criminal justice process to finish, to be able to start to get some of those questions answered, you know, right away, and to start the healing process much earlier, and to find something that they felt was sort of a much greater sense of justice than they were finding sort of inside the courtroom.
And this is a program that's voluntary. Nobody is forcing, say, the person who is the family survivor of someone who's been murdered, for example, to meet with the perpetrator.
Absolutely. So all of the requests that we handle on those serious and sensitive cases are victim initiated. So you might have a surviving family member in a homicide case who, again, has had questions potentially for years or sometimes even decades, things that their family has torn them apart, and they're looking for answers. They're looking for information and, you know, want an opportunity to sit down with that person responsible. Because if you think about the traditional system, you have greater than 90% of cases that don't go to trial. Of the cases that do go to trial, only a small percentage of those do have a defendant testify. And in the case where a defendant does testify, it's not to say, here's what happened and why. It's to say, I wasn't there, I didn't do it. Well, that's not very satisfying to a surviving family member in a homicide case. So what we're serving to do is to sort of fill in a lot of those gaps and to help people find peace and healing in the aftermath of serious crime. And it has been tremendously effective. People have talked about it, this opportunity changing their entire lives, feeling like it has given them their life back.
Let's bring on another caller now. Jeffrey is with us in Madison. Jeffrey, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Jeffrey?
Yeah, so I had actually served time in the Wisconsin prison system. I made some mistakes when I was 17, and it resulted in doing about 10 years incarcerated. Five of those years was spent in a facility called Kettle Moraine Correctional Institution, and I was a part of the restorative justice program there. My biggest question in this scenario is, really, what are they going to define as the restorative justice program? Like, what is it going to include? The restorative justice program in the institutions, what they had us do was crochet hats and mittens and blankets for, like, homeless and hospital-needed people, which is great and all, but it really doesn't do anything for restoring justice to anybody. It doesn't help you learn anything.
Jeffrey, thanks a lot for the call. We don't have too much time left, but Jonathan, just because we call something restorative justice, in this case, sounds like may not be restorative justice.
Yeah, so absolutely. And I'm actually familiar with the restorative justice programs that do occur in the prison system. I wasn't familiar with one at Kettle Moraine, so I guess I'm probably not incorrect in that assumption there. So yeah, there are certainly many things that people might call restorative justice, but again, it really does need to contain these elements of, again, the key people involved, right? So individuals responsible for harm, those who have experienced harm, and community members, and looking to repair damage and repair harm that has happened, about addressing specific instances and about addressing what has happened in the aftermath of crime.
Thanks a lot for sharing your experience, Jeffrey. I want to spend our last couple minutes on an important side of this we haven't gotten into. Does this work? What do we know about the outcomes of people who've gone through restorative justice as opposed to the traditional legal system?
Certainly.
Or in addition to, I guess.
Certainly. So there's a lot of stuff. There's mountains and mountains of research and empirical data that is surrounding restorative justice. It has been extremely examined to a very high degree. And so everything that I'm going to talk about now, I'm going to just talk about some of the general statistics, but everything I'm going to talk about is based on meta-analysis, right? So we're talking meta-analysis studies, which is studies of studies. And so that brings our sample sizes into the thousands of cases, right? So thousands of individuals that we're looking at rather than individual instances. And so when we look at some of the meta-analysis, what we find, we're first going to look at recidivism. So that's, again, the likelihood of someone committing a new offense. And generally, what they found is that individuals who go through a restorative process versus a traditional criminal justice process, and we're talking for sort of similar offenses and similar offenders, their general reduction is about 30% reduction in recidivism for individuals who go through restorative processes. And some studies and some programs have found a reduction of recidivism by as much as 50 to 80%, which is certainly incredible. Another element is looking at an area of restitution. And so what they found when they've looked at individuals who participate in restorative justice is they find about a 25 to 50% greater likelihood that restitution is fully satisfied. And I think the reason for that is because of this really human interaction. Rather than having a judge tell someone, and you're going to pay $600, you actually, again, sitting face to face and having to hear from the person whom you have harmed how and why that's important to them and what has happened, it really increases that sort of human connection and the likelihood of that happening. Additionally, there's found that there's greater procedural and outcome fairness, as well as satisfaction. So individuals, and again, we're talking both victims and defendants, are more satisfied and feel the process and outcome are more fair in a restorative process. And finally, what we've seen in some studies is some long-term health outcomes and even psychological impacts that are very positive. That what we're seeing is that individuals are less than half as likely to fear re-victimization, are much less afraid of the particular individual because they're no longer this scary other.
It's a good place to leave it. Jonathan, thanks for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
That's Jonathan Schar, director of the Restorative Justice Project at the UW Law School's Frank J. Remington Center, with us to talk about the idea of restorative justice. We also heard from State Senator Lena Taylor. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. Police departments around the country are facing challenges in finding enough recruits to make up for retirements by baby boomers and for resignations.
And the story is the same here in Wisconsin. For example, applications to join Madison's police department are down more than 40% in the last 5 years, and the rate of resignations has doubled in the same period of time.
Madison Police Chief Mike Koval attributes losing officers and the failure to attract new recruits to, quote, the unrelenting toxicity of the incessant criticism and scapegoating of the police.
Jim Palmer is the executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. He was just also appointed to Governor-elect Evers' Advisory Council on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform. Jim, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
How big a challenge is it for police forces around Wisconsin to recruit new officers?
Well, I can tell you, first, there's really no state agency or no repository to know for sure. I mean, no agency collects the data relative to law enforcement applicants or, the number of individuals that go into our law enforcement academies throughout the state. But I will tell you that as, I interact with our membership and, we represent, just nearly 10,000 members across the state. As I interact with our membership and police chiefs and sheriffs throughout Wisconsin, the most consistent theme that resonates is that they're having extraordinary difficulty attracting qualified candidates.
What about the size of the communities? You said it's fairly consistent throughout the state, but what about the size of the communities? Does that have an impact?
It does. I think smaller agencies throughout the state actually, in some respects, have a much more difficult problem because, they can't, provide the salary and benefits that a larger agency can. At the same time, a larger agency has different issues with crime and different criminal components that they have to combat. So, I mean, there are two sides to that coin, but when it comes to recruiting candidates, it's a statewide, it does appear to be a statewide problem, yeah. And it's one that affects local jurisdictions in particular.
Well, let's look at some of the possible causes. We've talked on the show in the past about how low unemployment can make it hard for some industries to find workers. Is that a factor for law enforcement as well?
You know, I think that may be a component. You know, there have been other times in our history where we've had low unemployment, and it doesn't seem as though law enforcement has had the difficulty that it currently is enduring in terms of attracting qualified candidates. So I think that probably plays a role, but it does seem that there are some indicators to suggest that, you know, the sentiment amongst many is that law enforcement is a dangerous job. That's not news to anyone. But it's a highly scrutinized one as well, yeah. And I think that has definitely had an impact.
Now, as you know, thousands of baby boomers are retiring across many different industries every single day across the country. Is that also a factor in the lack of numbers in terms of recruiting?
Absolutely. As you have more baby boomers retire, there's you know huge numbers that result in attrition. And there just aren't the new individuals coming into the profession, or at least expressing an interest in coming into the profession. And that really does represent a very disturbing issue, and it doesn't portend very well for our future in terms of providing public safety throughout the state.
The Wisconsin Professional Police Association has data from surveys of both law enforcement officers and the public to try to get a better sense of where challenges and opportunities are. So overall, how do Wisconsinites view law enforcement in their communities? Is there a difference, first of all, among racial lines?
There is somewhat of a distinction. What we found, though, is, and we take half a step back, you know, we started this effort about 6 years ago, and we really wanted to, as the state's largest law enforcement group, play a more proactive role in facilitating a public discourse on issues related to policing. And, you know, you see it in a lot of places throughout the country, police groups are kind of left to respond to controversies when they arise, and we really wanted to be part of a more constructive, ongoing public dialogue. And so we started this public polling effort, something we commissioned to the St. Norbert College Strategic Research Institute, and we wanted to gauge, you know, where are people on any number of criminal justice issues, how do they feel about law enforcement officers, and one of the themes that has carried over each of the 6 years that we've had this poll done is that Wisconsinites do hold police officers in very high regard. And so we, you know, this polling effort and the publicity we try to draw to it each year and is something that we do as much for the benefit of our members and those interested in potentially pursuing a career in law enforcement as we do the general public. And we think that hopefully has served to help some. Earlier this year, we conducted a survey of our membership. Included 103 officers from 30 agencies throughout the state, and we did find that the officers are generally satisfied with their jobs, but a growing number of them, it would appear, would not recommend law enforcement as a profession, and a significant majority, more than half, they noted a decline in the morale within their departments within the last 5 years, and that's something that all, you know, the entire state should be concerned about.
What about the size of the community that people live in? Did that affect how they answered?
It did. For the public poll, yes, it did. Those in smaller communities tended to have a higher favorability rating of law enforcement officers. Same would be true of older demographics. Older individuals tended to hold police officers in higher regard.
Jim Palmer is the executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. He was also just appointed to the Governor-elect Evers Advisory Council on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform. You asked both police officers and the public if they think working in law enforcement is getting more or less safe. What did you hear from folks?
We did ask those questions, and it was clear that, you know, people do have a sense that the job of a law enforcement officer is becoming less safe, and that's a sentiment that is shared by officers working within the state today.
Now, police-involved shootings can bring a lot of negative attention to law enforcement. Do you have a sense of how those incidents affect how the public views police?
I think, you know, really, when there are controversial incidents that occur throughout the country, obviously those garner a great deal of publicity, and certain narratives that emerge from the national media more so than anywhere in the state. And those clearly have an impact on how officers feel about their jobs and how they think the public feels about them. Here in Wisconsin, we really have, I think, been ahead of the curve in that regard. As you may well know, the WPPA worked with citizen advocates in 2013 and 14 in order to establish Wisconsin as the first state in the country to mandate independent investigations of officer-involved deaths. And, you know, we think that maintaining the public's trust is essentially important to, to the law enforcement's mission. And to date, only three states in the country have enacted that kind of reform. And so we try to be ahead of the curve, try to be a responsible participant in the public dialogue on these issues. And hopefully that has helped. I don't think that the local instances, you know, any critical incident or officer-involved shooting is impactful within the community in which it takes place.
Sure.
And so that's not to undermine that at all. But hopefully, you know, these larger, broader things and efforts that in which we've engaged have helped curb that somewhat.
In the 2018 survey of the public, 94% of the respondents said that they are in favor of requiring law enforcement officers to wear body cameras. Do you think that could improve relationships with the communities being served?
Absolutely. Yeah, I don't think there's any question about that. That's something as an organization that we've long supported. We recognize that, you know, it is still somewhat of an emerging technology, and it's not perfect. I mean, there are things that a camera can't do that the human eye can. But anything that can provide, you know, more in the way of evidence that the public can see in terms of and evaluate in terms of how an officer made the decision they did to use force, for example, I think benefits not only the public and the certainty they have about these situations, but the officers that have to, you know, carry out those duties.
Also, in the 2018 survey of law enforcement officers at your annual conference, only 21% said that morale in the department was better than it was 5 years ago, and 25% said it was much worse. Do you have a sense of what might be contributing to that?
I really do think it stems in significant part from the national narratives that our members see in the media, and coupled with, you know, what appears to be a very clear decline in the number of people pursuing a career in the profession. I think that has made officers feel that they're, you know, heavily scrutinized and in their view, oftentimes unfairly so. And as the state's largest law enforcement group, we just try to inform both our members and the public and bring about a more constructive public dialogue.
What efforts are you aware of here in Wisconsin to address that?
Well, it's interesting. A lot of local agencies have had to resort to essentially marketing campaigns in order to attract candidates. And so that's something that we've seen that the Madison Police Department, Milwaukee, Wausau has an excellent campaign of that nature. That's something that clearly has had more agencies feel the need to do. We've also, our organization has worked with other organizations around the state like the American Legion to sponsor week-long youth academies so that, you know, we can provide, you know, kids and juniors and seniors in high school with the opportunity to get some exposure to law enforcement and the issues that that profession confronts. And again, to try and warm people up to the profession and recognize how much of an important calling it really is.
Jim, thanks for taking the time for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jim Palmer is the executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. He was just also appointed to Governor-elect Evers' Advisory Council on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform. He was with us to talk about recruitment challenges for police forces in Wisconsin and beyond.
Coming up, our next guest says the way one Wisconsin town recovered from a major flood 40 years ago should serve as a model for communities around the nation. We'll find out why coming up on Central Time. In the summer of 1978, the small village of Soldiers Grove in southwestern Wisconsin was hit with the worst flooding in the community's history. It destroyed several buildings, including a new bank, and caused $500,000 in damage.
That event is ultimately what caused leaders to relocate the downtown area and several homes to higher ground. But perhaps the bigger success story, according to our next guest, is how the village did it. She said other communities that experience frequent and severe flooding can learn from Soldiers Grove, especially in the era of climate change.
Alexandra Tempest is the associate editor of The Progressive, which recently released a special edition focused entirely on climate change. Allie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Rob. I'm glad to be here.
Well, take us back 40 years. Soldiers Grove, before this big flood hit, there were no strangers to flooding. Give us a little of their story.
Yeah, no, that's correct. Soldiers Grove is a tiny village. At its height, it had about 700 people. It's nestled in, it's really idyllic land in the Driftless region of Wisconsin. So there's these ridges, and it's right on the shores of the Kickapoo River. You know, for most of its history, well, for the first 50 years or so, founded in 1856, you know, for those first 50 years or so, there wasn't a whole lot of flooding, not a lot of community memory of flooding until about the turn of the century. And it turns out that a lot of this industrial development, you know, things like farming, logging, paving, made it easier to flood. The ground wasn't capturing as much water. It was cascading into the river. Floods started happening. So then the village adapted to this lifestyle where every year, every fall, every spring even, they would experience a flood, and sometimes they would be minor, sometimes they would be historic, like in 1951, 1978, where people would have to evacuate their homes from second-story windows, you know, and even in the earlier years, would just get in the habit of, well, flood's coming, we have to empty out our storefronts, we have to empty out our homes and make sure that everything's prepared for the flooding, and then, you know, they'd get everybody on down to help, and then they'd bring stuff back in, and it was just a part of life.
And you write that leading up to this big flood in 1978, people in the area started to come up with a plan. The usual state of the art with flooding was you fight it. You build flood walls. You try to prevent the water from hitting you. They started developing a different, crazy plan, I think people thought at the time, move the community.
That's right. Yeah. So federal policy up until this point had really favored structural approaches to flooding. So things like levees and walls and dams, things like that to mitigate flooding. But what this town had experienced was this, you know, a year after year repeated events. And we know from the research that when things are repeated, people are more likely to think, well, maybe I should leave or maybe I should move. And so people were, you know, the town started exploring this idea of moving to higher ground.
And it can be tough to make a decision like this. It can be tough for a community to, you know, change the parade route on 4th of July, much less move their entire community. And that's part of what you focus on, the process and community buy-in.
Yeah, really, what the research says is that these programs are successful when they are community-driven, when they come from the ground up. And so there was a lot of footwork that had to be done ahead of time to sort of, you know, spend time with the community, have these village meetings, have a, you know, door-to-door survey, asking folks what they wanted of their new relocated town. It took time to change hearts and minds. It was, as you said, this kind of relocation approach. Previously, the Army Corps of Engineers had really considered relocation sort of socially unacceptable. It was a non-starter. There had been relocations before this time, but none that was really a bottom-up, you know, driven, government-funded relocation program that was funded by these home and business buyouts. And so it was kind of, they were pioneers in this respect. And then it turns out that once they did it, people started pointing to Soldiers Grove as an example of how this could happen. This could actually work.
Talk about the outcome. What did Soldiers Grove, the new moved Soldiers Grove, look like?
So, it's still to this day kind of this bifurcated village. There's the old town down in the original 1850s location with the traditional architecture, and a lot of that is very residential. There's not a lot of business because they moved the central business district up and around the corner and onto the side of a ridge there. In that new area is sort of all of the buildings have the same style, the same look. They have this wood siding, and they have these solar paneled roofs. And that's kind of what the town became known for, and what it got a lot of national attention for at the time was this solar town, effort to use solar panels to power the town. So that was a big part of the story. But really, they became known for, among people who study, natural disasters and flood mitigation for their relocation, in the longer term.
Talking to Alexandra Tempest from Progressive Magazine, talking about her piece on Soldiers Grove and how they moved after a flood 40 years ago. And there's a reason you're looking at this now, Allie, in the time of climate change. Why is it important to look at this example from Soldiers Grove?
Well, Soldiers Grove really became the model that was pointed to by experts. So, for example, in 1993, the Great Flood of 1993 that spanned six states across the Mississippi River, the Association of State Floodplain Managers pointed to Soldiers Grove. They went to Congress, to the Clinton administration, to government agencies, and they said, hey, look at what happened in this small town in Wisconsin. They relocated. They did it. And then, over time, because of the example that Soldiers Grove, these about 12,000 or so communities, and we're not talking municipalities necessarily, but communities along the Mississippi ended up moving and relocating. And Soldiers Grove, as an example, was a big part of that. And so now we're dealing with increasing flood events. And, going back to industrial development that started the floods back in, turn of the 20th century, now industrial development is, exacerbating flooding by contributing to warming and climate change. And so now we're seeing warmer atmosphere. Clouds can hold more moisture. We get heavier and more intense rains, more unpredictable floods. And that's just one climate impact. I mean, you can look to California to see what's happening out there with the fires, and people are in Paradise, California are considering, should I move back to my town that doesn't exist anymore? We're really looking at Soldiers Grove as an example of why or how relocation can work. So there are lots of, in the age of climate change now, there are lots of communities that are considering moving back, coastal communities moving back from the shore, towns that are on rivers like Soldiers Grove having to move. There's buyout programs that fund relocations in every state in the country. And these are used in the wake of Hurricane Sandy in New York. They were used in the wake of Hurricane Harvey and Katrina, but also just in towns that are experiencing slow-moving sea level rise, like in Alaska and Louisiana. So this is something that's only going to get more and more relevant and to the world that we're living in.
You say we're doing this in all 50 states now. Are we doing it enough? Are we planning enough? Do we have the resilience in place to allow a community threatened by flooding or other climate change outcome? Are we ready to do this a lot?
Well, that's a good question. Right now, I spoke to Housing and Urban Development, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, back in 2016. So this is prior to the Trump administration. And they, actually said they were kind of hesitant to use this word, but they did say these people are climate refugees at this, so they acknowledge the seriousness of the situation. At the same time, they're very hesitant to want a direct mass migration from the top down. And relocation and, moving people around is politically very sensitive. Municipalities don't want to lose their tax base. And, we don't want to be telling people where they should live and where they can and cannot live. But it's also, we do know that it's going to be necessary. Climate change is making certain places in this country uninhabitable. And most climate migration happens within country borders, not across country borders. So we need to, and this is what the experts have identified, is we need to find a set of best practices and standards for deciding how to best implement these programs. Because right now, how it works is the federal government just gives funds to states and municipalities and then just lets them design their own programs without having a set of best practices in place.
We'll leave it there for now. Allie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rob.
That's Alexander Tempest from the Progressive Magazine talking about her piece on the recovery of Soldiers Grove after a severe flood and how it can be a model for communities around the nation.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the IRS has seen years of budget and staffing cuts. According to a new report, that means fewer audits of wealthy people and lots of unpaid taxes. A co-author of the report gives us details.
And on this week's edition of Food Friday, it's time to make some holiday desserts with chocolate recipes, scones, and more. Join the fun and share your favorites, that and more, coming up tomorrow on Central Time.